I dreaded coming to a pub to read because my experience at a White House in Limerick. You know, competing with drinkers and the noise of it and so on. But anyway, so you're all quiet and while I have you in quiet, I'll just get started with it. The first poem I want to read tonight is from my first collection. It's called Non-Symmetry. And it's was inspired by a trip, by happening to see a non-symmetry carol and being struck by these stark white crosses with just the name religion, name of religion, and no sign of dates of birth or death or regretted by nothing like that. And it set me thinking about what is life about and these lives of self-sacrifice and so on. So this is called Non-Symmetry. Row after row, almost identical. Low black railings enclosing little plots, from each of which a white, simple white cross sprouts to Sister Pius, Catherine, Gabriel. Clocks could have been set by those lives, those days learned by rote. Yet no one is left to tell what emotions ranged behind the veil, whose souls grew radiant or nebulous. But now they are at rest, those whose hearts bowed to chastity and prayer, whose dark habits and clacking rosaries were set for high notes, those whose voices broke, and those who found their God. One of the most awful things that could happen to a parent, I think, is a caught death. And fortunately, I've been spared that. But this poem is an attempt to imagine what it must be like. Caught death. Even still, the open doors on dolls and grasses, the empty cot, a dress waiting for her to grow. Laying her down was hard. But now the least thing brings her up, beaming, making towards them unstoppably. So as we're, you're all familiar with the giant panda, that emblem of the worldwide conservation movement, that snowy face, those shaded eyes. And this poem sees the giant panda through the eyes of a leading expert. I'll just read it again. The giant panda. When the leading expert, Professor Pan, was a child and first saw the giant panda, he was fascinated by the snowy face, the shaded eyes, its lumbering gait and shy, solitary air. But he could not have known then what it would entail. Years of pleading with governments to ease deforestation, using electronic collars, hidden cameras, camouflage, to monitor and preserve this bamboo gourmet, daintily, indolently chewing leaves and shoots. Years learning, sifting, ordering. As the habit has kept shrinking, as numbers kept depleting, his purpose becoming clearer. To distill a life into pure panda, the record of all that he had seen, all that might have been. Yeah, okay, caught death wasn't based on personal experience. Next one was, it's called After the Crash, and it goes back quite a while to my bachelor days. And coming back from a dance one night, tired after a week's work, and maybe the few pints didn't help either, so I ended up in this situation. Maybe I've dramatized it a bit. There weren't sirens or anything like that, but anyway, the basic idea is sort of there now. After the crash, there had been so many journeys, so much foraging for passion, so much groping through froth and smoke, that when my car spun off the road, I could scarcely reconcile the one who had been a hive of dreams with the figure struggling from the mess, its watch still ticking through the sirens into a dawn of shattered glass. Remember when we used to get summers, and there was one glorious summer in 1995, and I remember we were there in Nacos, and this poem sort of commemorates that, and it's dedicated to my wife, who is not here tonight, but anyway, Nacos, for Margaret. Someday, maybe, I'll be able to see it purely as it is, without prospect or retrospect. See the rusting cars and tractors as just a feature of the landscape, like the stone-walled fields, haycocks, sheep. To walk the unpeopled roads, saying the names without nostalgia, Bohor na Morav, Balak and Claw. And to see you there now, after a swim, splashing out through the shallows on the track of the risen sun. My second book then. And the first one is called London Irish, and based on a documentary I saw, an interviewer asking these Irish men about their lives in London, and of course predictably broken dreams, and a lot of it fairly pathetic. But it was this spirited man anyway, living in an abandoned car, but he was quite upbeat about his life, suggesting that everything would be perfect. Everything was perfect except for the missing steering wheel and the cracked glass and so on. This is called London Irish. And a question, the interviewer's question, begins to each of the first two sentences. Your first impression of the bright lights, they recall merry gatherings, the women sparked in dreamy flats, mornings that felt like mattress springs. So what happened? The smooth voice probes. They start mumbling, become tongue-tied, as if the years had mined the road back to Kilburn and Cricklewood. Now, as the closing credits roll, a toothless drunk brags that the car he calls home is perfect, but for cracked glass, the missing steering wheel. This one is called District Nurse, and if I can find it. Yeah. Well, you know the way they go around, and a lot of what they do must be fairly manageable, like bandages, ointment, stuff like that. But then if you're faced with no hope cases, people terminally ill, it becomes more difficult. And then it comes down to words, and they have to risk words and hope that words have some effect. And they may have, they may not, it's a gamble. So this one is called District Nurse. She tends to a wide area, visiting mothers of the newborn, those convalescing or house confined, her car mudded from lock-spec lanes, its paintwork scratched with briars and thorns, each sag and dinge just left as found. She ministers with practiced care, her fingers deft at dressing wounds, dabbing powder, rubbing ointment in, waiting to take a temperature or mitigating chronic pain, she hums and jokes to ease the binds. And to those who cannot reconcile, or those at death's door, words are all she can offer. Each one a dare into the dark, to heal or fail. Her voice soothing, salvaging still, trying to make light to steer clear. A feature of the Irish countryside, I suppose you people being based in the city wouldn't be that familiar with it, but the bachelor farmer. Bachelor. His grey hair wisping out beneath a constant cap, he hunches on the bar stool. Under a carapace of half chat and cliche, the sun was splitting the stones. He could make that fiddle talk. His heart is blindly casting, his words life belts dragnets. Then home by narrow roads, entering the yard to find every window lightless. The ashes piling up, a lone mug, scraps and crumbs, the clock ticking, ticking. And yet he's at the core of things, watching over calving cows, setting crops, his silage pits distilling meadows, harvests spilling into grain bins. And yet, sometimes at odd moments, maybe while raising a glass or tending lambs, or flicking off fag ash, the years flash back at him as fresh as yesterday. Summers that seemed free of rain, a match about to start, dances, airy dresses. And sometimes he's jolted out of roused sleep, groping, dreams fleeing the bare sheets. Well, I don't have to tell you about November, what a dreary month it is. Thank God it's a bit farther away from us now anyway. I'm afraid this poem does nothing to lighten the gloom of November. So here we go anyway. November. Here, the grey spies are digging out the spuds. Grizzled, stooped, they lug each bank to the pits. An odd bird darts from the scraggy hedges. Twilight falls on a trail of stalks, deep ruts. At Quinn's house, lights burn late into the night. The glum young man, it's whispered, met his own end. Morning words stumble on unsayables. Prayers are absorbed in the festering wound. Sunday Mass, the burial. Gatherings and scatterings, glasses drained to the dregs, darkness leaning into the afternoon, the hunters coming home with empty bags. You remember, or may have heard anyway, of the, you remember the tradition back in the 18th and 19th century of these poor women allowed into fields after harvesting. You know, they were called gleaners. They were allowed to pick up any the heads of grain that were left or whatever. In this poem, I think of someone like myself who is pained at by the hedges ruthlessly cut down and so on. But I think, well, the branches that are cut down can be used for firing. And so on. So maybe writers are ultimately gleaners that use leftovers, cast-offs to make poems, whatever. This one is called Gleanings. Do not mourn free-ranging hedges, nor wince at these unsheltered ways. Just follow in the wake of the flailing, trimming blades, humbly, like a gleaner. Imagine the dead twigs as perfect kindling. Dream of winter nights crackling, ablaze with mangled branches. And finally from this book, a poem called Retrospect, which was looking back, nothing. Looking back is disappointing ultimately. This poem is divided into two parts. The first part is called Stream. stream. There, the same high-hedged field, ripening for grazing or for hay. The bridge, that stretching stream. So much born, so much seeping in. You wonder, could you still paddle under the canopy of white thorn and hazel? Still kneel to drink from cupped hands. And the second part is called Well. It's all here. Chumescent houses, stretch marked fields, smoother roads, the traffic coming and going. Yet in the heart's holy pockets, this undiminished urge to retrace steps, to probe beneath the tangled undergrowth for the trodden well path, and to seek in the scummy, shrunken well for that pristine spring you dipped your jug or bucket in.
And if you're not, if you still have time to listen to a few more, more recent stuff that's first poem is called Old Towel, and I see an old towel that's been washed over and over again, maybe as an emblem of well, aging and all that. And this poem is addressed hopefully to my wife to be understanding as I get older and all that sort of thing. So it's called Old Towel. Love, your modish talk of renewal makes me feel like an old towel that keeps absorbing the sweat and stains of cursory rinsed faces, hands, that endures the washing machine's caustic detergent, its dizzying spins. And what if each time I emerge less pristine, more prone to residues, fraying, dwindling in fragrance into sheen, and becoming what I've always been. I think it must be difficult to be married to a writer, to think partners know that this tendency to go into a world of your own and disappear, and maybe to suspect at times that the writing's more important than them, and who's to say they're not correct in that at times. This poem is called Beat. Whatever the origins, this need to fuse and generate, this straining for delivery is so ingrained in my being that even you, so practiced at reading my inner weather, sometimes must find it hard to tell whether these fingers pressing into your yielding flesh are harbingers of lovemaking or are merely marking beats for word spurts, furtive eureka. Just then, a few poems that sort of give an idea of my background, maybe. This sort of an intensely Catholic Ireland in a way. And anyway, this poem is called Christmas 1962, and I just read it. I don't think it requires that much explanation. When Santa brought me, the last boy in my class, still secretly believing that final gift, a brown football, I'd spend hours kicking it along the crusted snow. I imagined I was Jim Baxter dodging tackles, stroking pinpoint passes, or Jimmy Greaves ghosting past defenders to score the winning goal. As darkness descended on Ibrox and Parkhead, Old Trafford, White Hart Lane, I'd put away the highlights like a priest restoring the Stiborium. I'd an aunt who used to bring these little Catholic Truth Society pamphlets about the lives of the saints. And even, you know, even growing up as we did with all the Irish myths and legends, you know, Fionn putting his thumb in his mouth and becoming wise and all that, the Salmon of Knowledge, Pooh Cullen, all that sort of thing. What some of these saints did, what they were credited with, was extraordinary. And I mentioned a few things here, but there's a marvelous story of Elizabeth of Hungary who, in a time of famine and plague, took pity on the poor and secretly took out bread, took out food to the starving, afflicted masses. And this wasn't approved of by her household, so she was checked on. But one day she was going out and she was challenged. But when they opened her bulging pouch, they found not loaves, but roses, miraculously. And so this had a huge impression on sort of a gullible young lad anyway. So this poem is called Lives of the Saints. And as I said, my aunt used to bring these things up. Her sober black outfit, animated by a crocus yellow blouse, my aunt would search her bag for the slim booklet. Look, another saint for you. When Thuringia was ravaged by famine and plague, Elizabeth of Hungary renounced wealth, distributing alms, building a hospital. Once secretly taking bread to the stricken, she was challenged. But when they opened her bulging pouch, they found the loaves transformed to roses. Looking out on the vast plain of Fanjo, Dominic saw a star descend over the church at Prue, God's sign, as he believed, to start his life's work there. Fearlessly confronting the Albigenses, his arguments cutting like flaming scourges, so that the heretics could only foam in rage. On snow-white nights, I ponder Catherine of Siena's penitential fasting, her jubilation at shearing her long hair. In the Basilica di San Domenico, her entombed head incorruptible. Turning the pages, I could see Matt Talbot on his bare plank bed, could see the chains and cords unwinding from his flesh after death. The zeal of self-denial still visible in the reddened indentations. I wondered if prayer and abstinence could earn for me even a little miracle, to be free of nightmares pouncing on my sleep, to be spring-heeled in leaping for the ball, to unfurl my father's brow, thaw out his tongue. I'm interested in environment, all right. And this poem, as well as this poem, hints that, you know, the little things we do that have huge consequences, and we're always being told about this, I mean, global warming and stuff like that. So this poem is simply, it's just called So Much, so I'll just read it without further ado. So much depends, too, on ripples, traces, on how you read the signs, how the canary emerges from the mine, or even a flutter through the rainforest, raising hurricanes in the Himalayas. And then the natural world, the beauty of it, this poem is called Release. To hold in my folded hand a bird's destiny, to sense against my palm its beating heart, straining feet, and then to let it go through my fingers opening in that elemental upward push for a dream of perfected flight lines, incubating it. And don't feel like me, you go into a television, maybe in a pub or hotel or something, there's something absorbing on the television, and next thing, somebody somewhere presses the remote control and gone. And this poem is called Polar. Drawn from old pub bubblings to a TV program about polar bears, stranded on ice floes or paddling across the shrinking wilderness, I saw as much as anything else the fond immutables of my childhood drifting past. Surplus acolytes, unmolested whitethorn, the tales of Shackleton, Scott and Amundsen,
sledding into legend until someone pressed a button on the remote control. Divining, I just want to read this without comment, it's a brief lyric. Now, divining. You notice that thing of the diviner's holding a stick over and then it shakes and there's water underneath. That's right. Divining. What I cast for that altar now, the bread, the wine, the bowed heads uplifting in true evil. What stirs is not some holy god, but words quickening, binding, until I'm shaking like a rod. My father, my mother became very sort of invalided in her last year, so my father took over some of the looking after the house. And he had to look after the freezer, for example, but if he was storing bread or meat or stuff like that, he'd always tie the plastic bags with slip knots. You know, the knots that can be just like lacing your shoes. They're knots that can be easily unknotted, if you know what I mean. So this poem is called Slip Knot. In a spring cleaning burst, I try to clear the old freezer. Lifting the lid, I find ice. Even plastic wraps feel stiff and brittle. The bags my father tied are hard as stones. A wheaten loaf, sliced pans, his relished side of bacon, fish kept for Fridays, a clutch of buns. Still, after all we had been through, I'd slip these knots if I could tell what yet would thaw to savouring from what's no longer edible. You know, I suppose all these psychologists say, well, arsonists, there's something behind it, there's some dysfunction, some disturbance behind it. And this poem is called Arsonist. When he was led in shame from court, tongues wagged about the streelish look of him. Those blank, staring eyes, no girl would have him. And what lurked in his head, his heart? There are theories, I suppose, plausible tags. Loss, trauma, childhood pain, thwarted urges which struggle to be known. But what if it boils down to this? A hearty governable itch to hear fire crackling in hay barn or stubble, to see the world as purely combustible, as shoots of flame, and strike the match. And then these people, you know, living in lone houses that have the habit of being out for to a dance or to a pub, of giving the impression there's somebody left at home. You know, turning on lights, leaving angry dogs about the place that will bark and stuff like that. But people aren't really fooled. The people close to them know there's nobody home, really. So this poem is called Gone. For years before it happened, when he'd go into town to drink, to scour nightclubs for a woman, he'd leave at safeguards yelping dogs, the TV blaring, and lights on that burnished even the backyard's idle sheds, the rust-dulled tractor. Too late for that, they'd say, too late. Everyone knew he'd gone away, and not just then, but long ago.
Okay, I'll just say two more then. One of the things about teaching, I suppose, is that eventually you, and unfortunately, you hear some pupils taking his own life or taking their own life, whatever. So this poem is called Dart. Now, hearing that July night you have been found hanging in some outhouse,
I thought of your crumpled report sheet. Disruptive, flying paper airplanes. No homework, late again. And how when challenged, you just mutely shrug. Your eyes like doors opening to a maze of corridors. Then slouch away. As you keep slouching back, fretting me with questions about freeing voices, about tightening nets. My red biro still hovers over writing strained as yours. When my students volunteer to act out characters, I hear you clamoring to play Bull McCabe. And sometimes in restless classes, I half expect a paper plane like those so lovingly crafted you'd launch from your back desk to dart through the air, wobbling late in flight, nosediving at my feet. And finally, you know, Lives of the Saints is one thing, but I think the record of the church as it emerges, you know, the Catholic Church as it has emerged in recent years, has been scandalous, really, has been a disgrace in many ways. And this poem is called The Holy Show, and it's about another priest led before the courts for serial child abuse. And it's called The Holy Show. When he was sentenced, some could see, beneath grey hair and pudgy face, the young curate of Westland Row, famous throughout the parishes for his Elvis impersonations with the priest group, The Holy Show. Testifying, the victim spoke like one fermenting in recall, as if he'd been shaping for years to retell his ordeal. Back in the furry glen, the priest buggering him on a cream mattress, then unfolding his purple stole to wipe away the mess. Often too, when he's just served mass, his sobs blared out by rock and roll, and Bible-waving threats that if he blabs, he'll roast in hell. After another incident, the priest is retrieving his jacket. A small receptacle for hosts slips out of the pocket.